The following talk was given at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on July 17, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Morning, everybody. Thank you for anybody new who's joining us today. Appreciate it. I have a spider problem at home. And so I live in a place where, I live with my girlfriend, my partner, and, our child, and then her two other children. And, we live in a townhouse in Blaine, and, there's been spiders, ants, and most recently flies that are a part of our environment at home. And her reaction to seeing a spider or a fly or ants is to, let's kill them. let's get rid of them, And I struggle with that, and I have struggled with that for quite some time, and because that's not my initial reaction to insects or really anything for that matter. And so the point of me bringing this up isn't to say that my partner's wrong. This is nothing against her whatsoever. Perfectly normal, I think, or I don't know if that's the right word, to have that reaction. I remember growing up and killing bugs and insects, and I grew up in northern Minnesota, and so hunting is a part of the lifestyle up there. And I think that that's just sort of a part of our society, is that for whatever reason, I could go into my theories about it, but we don't have the respect for other beings. I think there's this hierarchy, that human beings are kind of at the top of the pyramid and everything else is below. And I had that mentality for a while, growing up, but it never really made sense to me. I always kind of struggled with that, and, I'm trying not to go off in the weeds on this, but I had a moment in my fifth grade, class where the teacher was breaking that down about how human beings are at the top of the food chain, and I that hit me, and I was just like, does that make sense? And ever since I think that moment, I've always kind of questioned whether or not that was actually true. Anyways, it's kind of a sidebar. So we have this fly problem at home. Currently we've had spiders, we've had ants. My partner has been like, we'll just kill him, and I won't do it. And I think she gets frustrated with me at times. And recently we've had these flies. It started with one, and that was fine. It's like, I can hear them buzzing a little bit, but it's like, hey, we're going to share the same environment, and it just is what it is. Then more recently, like yesterday, the day before, I see like four or five of them flying around, so it's becoming kind of an issue. And I still, won't do anything about it. I could open the door, I suppose, but maybe that leads itself to more things coming in. So the reason that I bring this up is I think this is kind of a last minute, addition to the talk that I'm giving today. But the reason I bring this up is because I think that's pretty common for us to look at things as being, almost like not welcome into our environment. We view them as a way as kind of separate, like that's your fly. You don't belong in my house, And so there's a different way to look at things. And I think a more wholesome way to look at things. And we talk a lot about wholesomeness in this practice. And so if we look at things as being separate and kind of apart from us, there's a tendency to do that type of thing is get out of here. You're not welcome. You know, and it just kind of leads itself to all kinds of destruction and chaos, you know. Whereas the other way to look at this, the more in-depth way to look at this is the fly, you know, the spider, it's a part of reality. You know, it's a part of wholesomeness. It's a part of wholeness. And so it's a much different approach to, I think, living life and not seeing things as separate. And in my experience, it's a much more peaceful way to live. And there's just a different approach that we can take to living this human experience, I think, than I was previously accustomed to. And so just a side note, that's not the basis of my talk today necessarily. Part of it is, though. So what I'm going to talk about today is based on the book, The Mountains and Waters Sutra by Shobhaku Okumura, who is a wonderful translator he's from Japan, and so he lives in the United States now. He's a teacher here, and he's done a number of different translations, and this one is the Mountains and Waters Sutra, which has taken me a long time to get through, actually. I think I'm going on like 9 months of reading this book, you know, and I've done several talks on this book, actually. I mean, it's very, very insightful, but it's taken me a little bit to understand what the Mountains and Waters Sutra is. Not getting to, but kind of like it's got a different language in it that I'm not accustomed to. And so it's really helpful to have a translator who, you know, is familiar with this practice and has really genuine insight to break this down for me. So that's what this is based on today. And, part of it is going to be the Buddha's, words, you know, and supposedly what he said. And then a part of what I'm going to break down is Shohaku's, in, you know, kind of commentary on what the Buddha said. And so if you haven't checked this author out, translator out, I would highly recommend him. Anything he's put out has been wonderful. So the Buddha has said, all things are ultimately liberated. They have no abode. Abode. And so I'm glad that you asked, because abode is one of those things that I always get, you know, curious about language and words and stuff like that. And sometimes I don't quite comprehend. So I actually start out breaking down liberated and abode. So I looked up liberated and abode online. And liberated is freedom from social convention or traditional ideas, freed from imprisonment. And I think this is our common interpretation of the word liberated. So in a way, we live in a socially constructed reality. We have an agreement. We have a common understanding of what things are, what things mean. And this is sort of like the normal social conventions. And so at an early age, what I realized, and I don't recommend this, by the way, I just want to point this out at the beginning. At an early age, what I realized is that I don't really have to live by these social constructions. You know, I don't have to live by your laws and your rules. I think a lot of it's BS. You know, I don't agree with it. And therefore I'm not going to live by this socially constructed world that you guys have developed, you know? And of course, there's rules that need to be enforced. There's laws that need to be enforced. And there are consequences if we don't live according to our rules and our laws in this society. So there's consequences, you know. And I paid many consequences as a result of not living according to our socially constructed world. So ironically, you know, liberation is freedom from imprisonment. And in a way, if we don't live according to conventional ideas, it can lead to prison, like actual prison, you know. So I don't recommend that. And abode is a place of residence, a house or a home. So this socially constructed world can feel comfortable. You know, it can feel like a home. As we grow up and we learn about our world, we get to know, you know, kind of who we can trust, who we can't trust, what routines and things we can rely on and what we can't. And so hopefully we adjust as we grow up and learn to live according to societal standards and norms. And hopefully we can get by in a, you know, a way that isn't too disruptive to ourselves or other people. And so this can feel comfortable. I know for myself, I really enjoy a good routine, you know, a good rhythm to things. And I can tell you that when I'm in a really good routine and a really good rhythm with living, just in general, waking up at a certain time, eating breakfast at a certain time, going to work, I have my little routines that I do with everything. I put my wallet, my keys in a certain place at home. When I go to bed at night, me and my daughter watch a little bit of, you know, Cocomelon and then MSNBC or whatever, before we fall asleep. And it's our rhythm. It's our routine, you know, developed a relationship that I can rely on and trust. And that's gotten comfortable to me. So all of these things can become sort of comfortable. And in a way, they can become an abode. They can feel like a home. We know what to expect. We know what's coming. And we rely on that, you know. So that's a type of abode. That's a type of like home that we can trust in some ways. And of course, we know that life doesn't always go according to plan. Our fixed sense of self is also an abode that we come to rely on. You know, we have this common way of viewing things where this is me, that's you. We don't question this. We don't question that things have their own independent existence. It seems to be an inherent part of human thinking that as we grow and we learn what things are. And you know, once I learn that a chair is a chair, I don't question that. That's a chair. You know, that is what it is. So when we talk, however, this contradicts actual experience. And this is the deeper part of what's being pointed out in these teachings. So this isn't necessarily social construction, you know, and that type of stuff. It is to some extent, but it goes deeper than that. It goes right down to the fundamental existence that we believe things have. And so when we're hearing, you know, the Dharma teachers talk about things and things as they are, try to pay attention to really what's being pointed out. And it's not your usual stuff. It's not our usual understanding of things. And it always goes a layer deeper. I shouldn't say always. But there's a deeper aspect, and deeper is a misnomer. I don't know what a better word is. So our usual way of looking at things that of liberation of abode, you know, in a way, especially abode, it contradicts your actual experience. And so everything is coming and going. Arising, staying for a while, changing, disappearing. So when I say, you know, it is a chair is a chair. Well, okay. In 1,000 years, is that chair still going to be that chair? You know, things change. Everything changes. Nothing is permanent. There's nothing that we can point to and say that this is going to stay permanent. This is going to be a fixed self throughout the duration of change. And this is the way reality actually is. It's impermanent. It's not fixed. So everything that we can point to, everything that we can name, is free from self-nature. This is one of the, I know Steve Hagen points this out quite a bit, that one of the great insights of the Buddha is this very idea, this very notion that there isn't a fixed self. Nothing is substantial, including self-nature. And a self would have to be something that doesn't change and is substantial. And if you really think about this, I know that was really profound when I first heard that. Because it was just it seems to be inherent in thinking, unless we notice, and unless we actually notice this and it's pointed out to us that there is nothing permanent. You know? And a self would have to be something that doesn't change. So a chair, if a chair actually had self-nature like we seem to always give it, it would have to not change. It would have to stay in that particular position throughout the duration of time and change. And I think we know when we really think about this and it's pointed out to us that that isn't true. There's nothing that we can point to that stays the same through change. And of course, through time, you know, change, whatever. So this doesn't align with reality. Our usual way doesn't align with reality because things are impermanent. So the baby is liberated from babyhood. And Buddhas are liberated from Buddhahood. Babies do not stay babies. And, you know, we know that they grow into adults and they're freed from babyhood. And this is actually more immediate than that. You know, it's more immediate in the sense that a baby isn't just freed from babyhood as time moves on. And I think that this will hopefully become more clear through this talk, but it's immediate, you know, immediately right at this moment. You are free from you. The chair is free from chair. The baby is free from babyhood. So a baby is a temporary identity. It's a temporary designation. You know, and it makes sense. We see a baby, we say, "Hey baby, how's it going?" So it's a part of our language. And I feel like a broken record with this, and I'm sorry for that, but you know, this is just a product of language, you know, and it's not bad. It's not bad to use these concepts. It's not bad to say that's a chair. It's not bad to say a baby's a baby, you know, it just doesn't capture the entire picture. So if we say a baby's a baby, we're overlooking the actual reality. And if we believe that a baby is a baby. Another example is a pedestrian. You know, this has been used here quite often. And so I apologize for the repetitiveness, but we can think of a pedestrian. And this is a fantastic example. I can't think of anything better. So if we see a pedestrian, it's fleeting. It's a fleeting designation for somebody who's walking down the street. When the pedestrian goes into Dunn Brothers and sits down and orders a coffee, is that person still a pedestrian? Obviously no. You know, they're not currently walking down the street. So they're not a pedestrian at that point in time. So it's not just pedestrians and it's not just babies. It's anything that we can name is a fleeting designation. It's a temporary sort of idea that we can have. And again, it's not wrong to have these ideas. It's very, very helpful, very useful to be able to talk to other people and talk about things. You know, and without this, I think, you know, we wouldn't be saying a whole lot to each other. So Buddhahood, it says Buddhas are liberated from Buddhahood. And Buddhahood is a state of perfect enlightenment. So we might think to ourselves, that's the goal. That's the destination. Getting Buddhahood. The overarching goal of why we sit meditation practice, maybe. Maybe that's an idea we have. Buddhahood isn't a fixed place. It's not a destination that we arrive at and then all of our problems go away. You know, which I actually really once thought that if I could just figure out what these teachers were pointing to, I could retire from life and not have to worry about anything anymore. I really thought that. I don't think that's true anymore, unfortunately. I can't see in the relative world a place where we don't have problems. We're always going to have problems, you know. But if we don't consider them problems, are they actually problems, you know? So there's a different approach. There's an entirely different way to view what's happening. But it's not a particular view. It's not something that I can convey to you or tell you exactly what it is. Because it's beyond or before language. It's beyond or before we put something into a package that we can then convey to other people. And that's why Dharma talk is different. It's pointing. But it's never going to hand you something that this is the truth. And then you can repeat it back to somebody else. So from here, and this is because I followed the passage in the book, it's going to go into something that I don't need to spend too much time on, but it's everything is walking everywhere within mountains and waters. So this goes back to what the Mountains and Waters Sutra is about. You know, they talk about mountains and waters. And so mountains is a metaphor for the network of interdependent origination in which we're coming and going. And in the back of the book, they break down, they give us a definition of interdependent origination. So the teaching that all things and phenomena are the product of an infinite number of causes and conditions. All these causes and conditions are also infinitely interconnected and constantly changing. Hence, all things are impermanent and lack an independent existence. They are empty. So that's interdependent origination. And that's mountains. And then waters is a metaphor for all beings, the way that all beings really are. So mountains is interdependent origination. Waters is a metaphor for the way all beings really are. And again, everything is walking everywhere within the mountains and waters. And so the mountains and waters are also walking without any resting place. So basically what's being pointed out here is that even impermanence is impermanent. So this kind of gets rid of all our ideas about anything, really. I mean, if we think we're going to pin down what impermanence is, we can see it, you know, but we can't pin it down. And so impermanent is so thorough that there's nothing to be impermanent. So to begin with, there's nothing that is substantial that changes to be impermanent. So this sort of clears the slate with this. And this is without exception. And so Okamura goes on to point out that this is the reality of impermanence. So a monk asked the master Senkan, what do you remember what the other name is for Senkan?
Sensong?
Is that what it is? So a monk asked the master Sensong, "Master, show me the way to liberation." Sensan replied, "Who binds you?" The monk replied, "No one binds me." Sensan said, "Then why do you seek liberation?" And this came up in my previous talk as kind of like repetitive. I don't know. For some reason, I get on these tangents for like a month at a time or whatever, where the same thing keeps cropping up. And so when I went through this, it's just like that's perfect koan for this. So our original nature is liberation with no abode. And that's what's being pointed out in this koan. The student goes to the teacher, says, "Show me the way to liberation." "Well, who binds you? You know, why are you coming to me to seek liberation? Like, who's binding you?" "No one binds me." Well, then why are you seeking liberation if no one binds you? And that's exactly what's being pointed out in that koan, is that the student's original nature is liberation. It is no abode. So the Buddha goes on. We should realize that although they are liberated without any bonds, all things are abiding in their own particular state. So although a baby is not fixed as a baby, it's dwelling in the Dharma position of a baby at this moment. And a Dharma position is each and every being dwells within its own. That's the definition that is given in this book. So again, we can't say that the baby is, and we can't say the baby is not. But we often go to these extremes. So when it's pointed out that a chair isn't a chair, we go to, well, a chair is not a chair. Right, but a chair is a chair. And so it seems like it's never-ending loop where it's just like you can't pin it down, you know? But we often go to these extremes. And again, I think it seems like this is an inherent part of thinking. Well, if it's not this, it must be that. Well, if it's not that, it must be this. So we try to pin things down and in order to really understand what something is. However, given the nature of reality, it's unpindownable, as you know, I think Norm coined the phrase, unpindownable. But we can't pin anything down. So we're never going to get the right idea of what's actually taking place. But this is what we do. We go to these extremes. And so everything is always changing. But still, at this moment, a baby is completely a baby. And we can't ignore the relative reality. We can't ignore that a baby is a baby. We don't need to. We don't need to ignore that. We don't need to ignore that. And there's a saying that's often used around here where mountains are mountains, mountains are not mountains, and mountains are mountains. And so at first, without understanding what's being pointed to here, our usual understanding is that things are things. There's no question. A chair is a chair. Then after we get exposure to this understanding, we can maybe start to see that well, actually a chair is not a chair. And we can start to see oneness. We can see how things aren't separate like we once thought that they were. So maybe at that time we think, well, that's the answer, that's it. If I can just rest in oneness, if I can just stay in oneness all the time, that's going to be the answer. That's going to be enlightenment. That's going to be awakening. And with that, if you're able to see what the mistake is that we can't stay in oneness. Like, it's not a destination that we can just arrive at and stay. We can't ignore, well, I guess we can ignore it. We can't get rid of the relative reality. We can't get rid of the temporary designations. And that's not necessary. So even after we see oneness and we start to understand that, we still have to live with our temporary designations. We still have to show up for work. And with the full understanding, we can see that although a chair is not a chair, it's still a chair. Although a baby isn't a baby, it's still a baby. However, at that point, we can see that a baby is a baby, but it's not just a baby. A spider isn't just a spider. A fly isn't just a fly. A fly is the entire universe. And this has always been kind of tricky for me in my own experience, that when it was pointed up that a cup is the whole universe, I thought that was crazy. How can the whole universe fit inside of a cup? Well, what's being pointed out is that a cup is the universe. It was never separate to begin with. And so a baby is not a baby, but it's also a baby. So a child is a child. A middle-aged person looks middle-aged, and an aged person looks aged. So we can't escape appearances. And in Zen, we say that things appear a certain way. And I was baffled by that for quite a while. We'd have the teachers point out here that this is just the way things appear. And I've come to really appreciate this word appear, because it doesn't grant the substantiality to things that we otherwise believe. So we say a chair appears to be a chair. It appears to be a chair because that's how it shows up. That's how things are showing up right now. And that's not wrong. It's not wrong to say that a chair is a chair. It appears that way. So there appears to be a child. There appears to be a middle-aged person. There appears to be separation. Of course, things look separate. There's nothing wrong with things looking separate, appearing separate. So although we know that age or change occurs, we often live in defiance of this reality. We can see, maybe, when impermanence is pointed out to us, there's no way that things are permanent like we otherwise thought that they were. And so we get some idea or understanding of impermanence. And even while we're looking, you know, in our thought experiments, we're playing this through and seeing that, wow, there's no way a chair can stay a chair throughout the end of time. You know, like we can see that, we can intellectually understand that. Simultaneously, we have the idea, and this is another thing that's commonly used here, is that we're a cork in the stream. Even though the chair is impermanent, I'm still here. I'm permanent, you know, and I don't think we consciously say to ourselves, I'm permanent, but we have this fundamental belief that we are something, that we are something specific. That even though the chair changes and we can see that it's impermanent, I'm still something that is here, that pertains to that over there and not necessarily me. And like I said, this isn't, I don't think, conscious that we do this, but it's like implied. It's like an inherent product of our thinking and understanding, our you know, regular understanding of the world and the way things are. So we can intellectually understand impermanence, but still unconsciously believe in permanence. And I don't prefer the word unconsciously. I just couldn't think of anything better to use. So I mentioned earlier that I have a child. Her name is Sophia. Several of you have met her before. We had a ceremony not too long ago. And boy, do I love being a father. I mean, just the best thing that's ever happened. You know, I really, really love it. So Sophia is not going to stay a toddler. She was a baby. Now she's a toddler. She's not going to stay a toddler forever, you know. And I've had my girlfriend point out to me a couple of times, like, enjoy this, Bo, because it's not going to last, you know. So I do. I really try to take the time that I have with Sophia every moment that I have. And I try to stay present. I try to stay with her and not distracted, which is very difficult. You know, I think I've developed an addiction to my smartphone that is probably not too healthy. You know, I look at it all the time. And so the moments when I find myself looking at my emails, when I'm with my daughter, I try to, you know, remind myself like, hey, stop doing that. You know, stop being looking at your phone instead of spending the actual time with your daughter. Because, yeah, I can be in the same room with her, but I can be somewhere else mentally and not really there with her. And so I've incorporated this into my practice of just being with what's happening. I don't incorporate it. I didn't say that right. But this is, it's a new thing in my life. So I'm really trying to cherish the opportunity to be with my daughter every moment that I can. And so it's so easy to take change for granted. It's so easy to take things for granted. And the reason that I bring that up is that impermanence itself is a gift. So maybe a part of us thinks that, well, everything's going to change. When we get the positive experiences, when we are having a really good time, we might think to ourselves, well, this, you know, this is going to cease to, you know, to be this way at some point in time, and that's not going to be good. But then when a bad thing comes up that we don't enjoy, impermanence is there. That's also going to change at some point. So impermanence, in a way, is a sort of gift. We can appreciate things more. And certainly, if we can see wholeness, if we can live out of wholeness, this isn't something that we have to think about. This isn't something that we have to intentionally put out there as a goal that we need to do. When we can see that things are not separate in the way that we commonly thought that they were, there's like an inherent compassion that's right there. And it's a completely different way of interacting with the world. Why would I hurt a fly knowing that the fly is not separate from me? Why would I treat somebody with disrespect and discrimination knowing that they're not separate, that this is reality, that they are a part of reality, that from the beginning they're not separate? So when it comes to ethics and seeing the way the world is through not separate, it's a radically different approach. And there isn't one specific rule or regulation for how to interact with the world. If we could see that this is part of wholeness, that it was never separate from the beginning, everything else, the way to act, will fall into place. I always have this little thinking over my shoulder, like, am I saying that right? Is what I'm saying making sense? Very, very difficult to say this stuff in a fluid way. So we have to live in our Dharma position here and now. We have to practice in the same way that a baby practices as a baby. And how does a baby practice? Well, a baby's just a baby. I've always been really awed and impressed, for lack of a better word, at how babies act. They don't act. They don't seem to act like we do, like I do as a grown adult. They don't calculate. They don't sit and think about something before they do it. They just act according to how they're feeling. The immediacy of how a baby acts is perfect. A baby is completely perfect in its action. Even all the messy stuff that happens, it's perfect. Absolutely perfect. You know, I could just sit and watch my daughter for hours, you know, just odd. I love looking at her and watching her eat food, you know, her, you know, everything about it is just like, I just really enjoy it. And by the way, I know obviously it's my daughter, and so there's going to be kind of this love, you know, for my daughter. But also looking at animals, looking at dogs, looking at insects, nature. It's really the same thing. There's no intention there. There's no calculation with animals. I've often, especially in my younger years, I've been kind of jealous of dogs. You know, they just get to live. Even like wild animals. It's like they don't seem to have this extra baggage of the human mind that causes them this extra amount of suffering. They just respond immediately. They just act immediately to what's happening in the moment. If a predator is coming after the animal runs. If an animal is hungry, it eats. When it's tired, it goes to sleep. It's been very inspiring, I think is probably the right word. Inspiring to see that. So I've always been awed by babies. They have a perfect practice. It's immediate engagement with activity. So we cannot escape our current reality, whether young, middle-aged, or elderly. And we don't need to, because we are simultaneously not separate from reality. So we might think, it would be so great to be young again. Well, sure. But it's also perfect to be middle-aged. It's perfect to be elderly. It's perfect. And it's not separate from the universe. It's not, it was never separate to begin with. So practice is the manifestation of our life force at this moment. We are completely right now, right here, and we take care of this moment. When it's time to wake up, just wake up. When it's time to do the dishes, do the dishes. When it's time to change the diaper, change the diaper, you know? And some of these activities can be kind of cumbersome, you know. Waking up. Waking up was a big issue at one point in time because the alarm would go off and I'd think, oh, it would be just so nice to lay here for a couple more hours, a couple more minutes. I don't know at what point this changed for me, but at some point it changed. It's not a problem to wake up anymore. When the alarm goes off, I just turn the alarm off and wake up. So it's just doing what needs to be done. I'm not always good at this, of course. I use the example of waking up. That has gotten better. I still don't really like waiting in lines, you know? I get impatient, and it's a time to practice. It's a time to practice. I still don't really enjoy changing the diapers, but I change the diapers, and I try to be with that experience. So what we do is completely this moment as a function of this dharmic position. That is life force, simply walking, moving, or changing. As Uchiyama Roshi says, this is half of the true reality. Impermanence is half of reality. So our fleeting designations and daily activities are half of reality. Impermanence, continuous flux and change, this is half of reality. The other side is that everything is always abiding peacefully in its dharmic position where nothing arises and nothing changes. Everything is there at this moment. So again, there's nothing permanent to be impermanent. There's no separation, no change. And this is the solid footing that we've been looking for. And it's obviously not solid, but it is solid in a way. So even though I'm Bo, and it appears that I'm separate, simultaneously, there's no separation. If we can see that, if we can live out of that, So this is a strange thing. And that's why Okamura says, that's why it's a wondrous dharma. We can't grasp it by thinking, so we try not to grasp. We open our hand and trust everything in this moment, in this body. That is our practice in Zazen. So reality doesn't fit into concepts. Doesn't mean concepts are bad. But it's beyond comprehension. So we open the hand of thought. We watch our minds. When we're sitting meditation practice, that's what we do, is we focus on the breath. We just watch. We just sit and observe. Be awareness and watch. There's nothing that needs to be done. We don't need to go into our thoughts and try to think a certain way. We just notice that the thoughts as they come up and as they dissipate. This is opening the hand of thought. We watch our minds. Just watch. There's nothing that needs to be done except watching. We can see delusion. At a certain point, it might become clear that anything that we think, if we're believing that what we're thinking is ultimately true and real, it's delusion. If we can't see our grasping mind, then it's likely because we're caught in our grasping. But the moment that we can see when we're being caught, when we're being pulled into our stories, we can see this, and this is a delusion. When I believe that the chair is a chair, and really believe that without questioning it, that's a delusion. When I say I'm Bo, and I ultimately believe that that's true and real, that's a delusion. That's a sort of delusion. But we can see that we're more or less than that. I don't know what the right way to word it is, but we're not just these fleeting designations. So in the Heart Sutra, these two sides are expressed as form is emptiness and emptiness is form. There is nothing called form. That is the meaning of emptiness. But emptiness is nothing other than form. This form as Shohaku at this moment. Everything is liberated from itself, and yet everything manifests just as it is. So we have to take care of this position. So emptiness, I don't know when it was, but it was pointed out that emptiness is really emptiness of a separate self. I think that was very helpful for me to hear that. So there's two quotes from Steve Hagen's recent talk that he gave, Unadorned Quietude. And it was right towards the end of his talk. And one of the things I've started to listen for when our teachers give talks is sometimes it's the little things that seem maybe unimportant, or little moments where there's a really clear way of expressing this that is often overlooked, at least in my experience. So I've started to listen for that stuff. Right at the end of his talk, he said, you don't see yourself as connected. You don't see yourself disconnected. You don't see yourself or them. We're all independent, but this isn't your life. And that's exactly what's being pointed out in this passage from the Mountains and Waters Sutra. We're all independent. So we're all independent. But at the same time, this isn't just my life.
So Peter has a comment. He says, great acuity and precision of expression in your talk. Exclamation.
Oh, thank you, Peter.
Well,
yeah.
For peace and harmony in your household, I recommend catching flies and taking them out.
Thank you. Yeah. Can I comment on that? I've thought of that, and the amount of time and energy that I think it would take for me to catch these flies without harming them, I think I would be spending most of my time doing that. Yeah. If you have a trick, let me know. Yeah.
I just wanted to point out, when you were talking about interpreting the regulation, there's also a very specific reference, which is Jesus on the Pada, the 12-fold chain of causation. And what you've been talking about, the source of confusion, the first link in the chain, from which arise all the other links, is ignorance. So that's what you were talking about, I think.
Yeah.
Our confusion and our trying to grasp and then our trying to hold on to something. But I did want to point out that there is that technical teaching from the Buddha about causation.
Yeah. Thank you.
I also, please forgive me for this.
Yeah.
But you were talking about self-nature at the beginning of your talk.
Yeah.
All of the 10 great precepts start out, self-nature is clear and obvious. So what is being referred to there? Since it's not, you're not talking about delusion.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up, actually, Mary, because I actually had this as a part of my talk, but I deleted it. Because I just didn't want to go there. But you're right. All the precepts start with self-nature is clear and obvious. What is that? And so self-nature, as it's being referred to in the book, is our usual sense of self. It's our usual sense of self-nature. When it's using the precepts, self-nature is clear and obvious. That is beyond our limited understanding of self-nature. So self-nature is clear and obvious reality with a capital R, wholeness, totality. This is clear and obvious. Unless we're deluded, at which point is probably not clear and obvious. But it is clear and obvious. It's always right here, right now. We're never separate from it. And so in our precepts, we say self-nature is clear and obvious. It is very obvious. I just was listening to a audio book by Brad Warner, and he talked about this enlightenment experience and how much of a letdown it was, you know, like when he finally started to understand what was happening and what this is. And it's very ordinary. So when they say self-nature is clear and obvious, it's very obvious. I mean, this, at the end of the day, like, this is not pointing to something that is special. It's ordinary. Like, this actually is very ordinary. And so self-nature is clear and obvious, the exact opposite of what is referred to in this book. I don't know if that's the right way to word it. Well, yeah, that's why I said, I don't know if I'd word it that way. Yeah. So it's not the opposite, but it's the other side. Yeah. Does that answer the question? And thank you for bringing up the interdependent origination. Appreciate that. Anything else?
Ken says, thank you, Bo. Your talks are always easy to relate to.
Thank you.
I have an anecdote.
Can you hear me?
Okay. About the flies. I was in Japan on a bus full of tourists, and the person sitting next to me was from Australia, and a Japanese hornet came by and buzzed in her window. And the Japanese hornets can sting more than once. They don't lose their stinger and die. And she panicked a little bit. But all tourists in Japan have to carry a handkerchief for a number of reasons. And I got out my handkerchief. I put it around the hornet and took it and got stung through the handkerchief. But I took it to the door of the bus and let the hornet out. And the whole bus burst into applause because she was panicked and I was freeing the damned hornet. But anyway, that just happened. I don't know if it works with flies. Flies are much harder to catch. Yeah.
They are.
That was Peter Wilson.
Yeah, thank you for that, Peter. Yeah, and it does seem like flies are a little bit harder to catch than bees. Yeah. Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.